Welcome to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Our focus is commercial real estate, exploring vital questions confronting commercial landlords, property and asset managers, investors, brokers, tenants, and anyone providing services to the industry. Your host is Howard Klein. His commercial real estate practice over 35 years has concentrated on broker, leasing, and property management issues. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented with the sole intent of educating listeners. Howard and his guests are specifically not offering legal advice. If you need legal advice, consult your own counsel. CRE Radio is available live and downloadable anytime at creradio.com. Call in during the live show with your comments or questions, 619-393-6492, then press 1 to be placed in queue. And now, here's Howard Klein.
Hello and welcome to Commercial Real Estate Radio. I'm your host, Howard Klein, and today's show is How to Get the Lease Signed, Shortcuts to Avoid Protracted Negotiations. Our featured guests are Ira Meslick and Joel Hall. Now, maybe you could call us the Three Caballeros, because we are definitely, this should be a fun show, because the three of us definitely have a tude, and I expect that we're going to have a lot of fun. Our call-in number is 619-393-6492. Please press 1 to talk. Leave any comments. You could also leave comments on Twitter using the @creradio.com. You can leave questions on our website at creradio.com. Or you can leave comments directly on the page of this show by going to, and I don't know if I have to use the HTTP, but it's http://creradio.com/the-lease. So why don't we get into the show, and let's talk a little bit, if I might, introduce my two guests, Ira and, well, I typed in here Joe's, but it's Joel. Ira and Joel both, and I have spoken to both of them and have, Ira, you and I have not personally met, but I've met Joel on a couple of occasions. Both are very, very articulate, intelligent. This will be probably the last time I'll say anything nice about the two of them. Knowledgeable in commercial real estate and landlord tenant matters. Ira is a very prolific writer. He just turns this stuff out at least once a week. And Joel is also a very prolific writer, tending more to address himself to lawyers. So he's the one who likes to train all of the lawyers. Joel is a very experienced lease negotiator and attorney. And frankly, I like talking to him partly because he's kind enough to allow me to tease him. I also intend to continue to do that during the show and add Ira to my trusted group of teasees, or whatever that means. It's a new word I created. The idea from today's show came from one of Ira's articles. That article is entitled, Can We Tamp Down This Document Negotiating Fire and Just Get the Deal Done? That was published on Ira's blog on January 6th, and you can get to that at http://tinyurl.com/cdy39F6. In this article, and when I read it, Ira suggested an approach and some language that a landlord and tenant can agree upon up front to avoid arguing over what he considers the most obvious points of the agreement. And so, Ira, before we get any further, do you agree with my summary of your article?
Well, first of all, I want to thank you for inviting me to join Joel and your audience today. So thank you, Howard. And I didn't catch that tiny URL, so I might suggest that the entire blog is at retailrealestatelaw.com. It's at retailrealestatelaw.com, and all of those are on there. I think you've characterized it pretty well in general. The particular blog posting you're referring to is one of a series where I'm expressing a frustration that the process is getting in the way of getting a lease done, and that basically my experience has told me that almost all leases wind up with certain concepts in the lease, no matter where the form starts from, and that we're making, in my view, a large mistake by sending out form leases from the landlord side and the tenant side, and I'm guilty of both, that require the other side to tell us, hey, wait a minute, this is not how the lease is going to wind up. We know that each party is going to be reasonable in giving their consent in all but identifiable places, so why not say that at the outset? We know that parties are going to give people 30 days to cure non-monetary defaults if they're curable, not 20 or 15, so why send out a form lease that says you have 20 days when the universe agrees on 30 days? The frustration, I think, that this creates is that we begin the process as non-essential adversaries. We begin by arguing with each other, you know, jostling for position, and we haven't even gotten to the question whether it's really important that the tenant maintain a particular trade name or other things that are specific to the deal, whether it be the location or the particular tenant or particular landlord. And so, yes, I think you're right. I've written in this particular piece and other pieces that I believe that there are universally acceptable outcomes commonly found, overwhelmingly commonly found in final leases. And I think that regardless of who presents the initial form, if the lease started that way, we wouldn't have, to steal your thunder, we would not have the following discussion. After somebody's marked up a complete lease, and it looks like who did it and ran, right, the other side responds, you've made too many changes.
All right, well, let's just stop a second. Joel, have you ever heard that comment?
Oh, yeah. And again, I would add as well, thank you, Howard, for having me. And Ira, good to be with you again. I've had that response from a landlord, but let me step back a second and just respond to what Ira's saying. I think what Ira is pursuing, and I don't disagree with him, that in the perfect world, there is such a thing as a balanced lease. But what I have found is that what is a balanced lease is almost unachievable, except for 20 to 25% of the cases. And the instances that Ira just cited, I would totally 100% agree with him. I think what that does is put you on the 20-yard line rather than starting at the 1-yard line to getting your lease done. But I think once you get beyond those non-really contentious issues, there are issues that come up that both sides have a legitimate interest and neither side is behaving badly. It's just there are differences in opinion. Now, to your question, did I ever get a response that said you made too many changes? Yeah. I dealt once with a big East Coast developer, and they had a very onerous form, and then they issued what they called a more tenant-friendly form. And when I reviewed this tenant-friendly form, they did throw in a few reasonables here and there and not much else. So I made my usual response, and I got this offended response back from the landlord's attorney, like, we don't think our lease form warranted your level of response. And my response to that was, well, I only responded to the things I happened to disagree with. And that was really the problem. From the landlord's attempt to make it more tenant-friendly, there's much they couldn't let go of. And in some areas, I don't know if you can reach a balanced lease. I have negotiated balanced leases for major tenants, but would it work with every landlord everywhere? And would it work for this tenant everywhere? That is my frustration in the process. I wish there were, even though I, you know, it would take away all my billable hours, I wish there were a balanced lease, because there are times I just hate going over the same ground over and over again where I know and Ira knows and Howard knows where we're going to wind up.
Well, let me throw something in here, if I might. Just getting back to the question of you've made too many comments, and I have a slightly different perspective. The two of you deal primarily with larger tenants / or larger landlords.
But not exclusively.
I get it.
Primarily,
not exclusively.
Yes.
But you know, in the situation that I deal in, sometimes I will be representing a landlord. I rarely represent a tenant that's 1,000 or 1,500 square feet. I rarely represent a mom-and-pop tenant in lease negotiations, because neither one of us can really afford the thoroughness that is necessary. But from the landlord side, if I'm dealing with a strip center and some tenant comes in and hires a lawyer, who they have to do an absolutely, positively, extremely thorough review. And for 1,000 or 1,500 square feet, you know, I'll get a 25-page memorandum. In the older days, now I get a lease marked up, you know, that addresses every possible issue. And I have gone back and said, too many changes. I'm not even going to talk to you.
Well, you know, Howard, I made a couple of notes,
and
a couple of things that Joel has said, and I don't disagree with Joel. Joel used two phrases. One was several times balanced lease, and the other was behaving badly. Right? I don't think that a balanced lease, Joel or Howard, is the objective, because it isn't a question of balance. It's a question about bargaining power. But behaving badly is what I'm trying to address. And let's say that, in fact, that these standard items that will wind up in the lease and should be in the lease and don't take from anybody comprise 25% of the black line changes, of the interlineations. Right? When you argue over those 25%, you start with a relationship between the negotiators that poisons discussing legitimate business issues. It corrupts the trust when you're dealing with somebody who says, I don't know what material means. I don't want to use the word material because who knows what that means. Right?
I'm with you.
Okay, and whatever. And I think that what I'm talking about is that 25% goes through the process, and no matter how mature you try to be, there are only a handful of people that have achieved the dignity and the grace to listen to such claptrap and to hold their temper and hold their tongue.
Current company excluded, of course.
No, I'm as guilty as the next person. It's just the older I get, the less quick I am on the uptake.
All right, if I could, guys, we're going to have to take a short break. When we come back, I'd like to talk about some of these words and some of your suggestions in your article, Ira, that, I think can not even so much subject to interpretation, but some people may think of it as reasonable and not. So why don't we take a little break? Gentlemen, if you can mute your microphones, or I will take care of it during the break, and we'll come right back in a few moments.
Go mobile with the analyst. When the deal changes, and you know it will, be ready whenever, wherever, to update property analyses with the analyst. Multi-page reports in seconds sent straight from your mobile device to your client's email. Environmental summaries delivered right to your iPhone or iPad in as little as 10 minutes. Free from your desk at last with the analyst. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Todd Kuhlman, and links to the analyst.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests,
please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Why don't we talk about the word, if I might, reasonable?
Well, Howard, this is Joel. Can I just give a 30-second response to what Iris said before the break?
20 seconds,
okay. Ira said it's about leverage, and I guess from my viewpoint, I was approaching the centrist or balanced lease of you take away the leverage, you take away everything and look at it as purest philosophical sense, is there a balanced lease? Forget leverage, mom and pop, or major chain. And I say it is possible in 20 to 25% of the provisions. That's what I was saying. It's not possible with anything beyond those numbers. But go ahead. That was my comment.
I think that's a fair comment. But from a practical matter, and usually you're the one who's trying to push practical, Joel, I don't know that, you know, balanced really makes sense. I totally agree with Ira on this issue. Is the bottom line and what will dictate the terms of the agreement will be the relative strengths and weaknesses and the bargaining strengths and weaknesses of each of the sides.
The lease, we said 25% and balance and so forth. Half of the lease goes untouched. Just untouched. We usually don't muck around with the gender clause, by way of example. And there's many provisions that just don't get touched. That's the way they are, for two reasons. One is they don't need touching, and the second reason is the parties don't really understand what they say anyway, and so they just accept that this is the same thing they've always seen. Then you have the provisions that I think ought to be put into that category. They're generally acceptable, you just pass over them, and you're then left with certain provisions which are the tug of rope between the landlord and the tenant, essentially talking about the assumption of risk. Mm-hmm.
Well, Ira, why don't we get to some of those instances? You like to not only insert the word reasonable, but you think that there should be boilerplate language in every lease, or you should start out with boilerplate language that in essence says whenever any act is required by any of the parties, they're obligated, each of those parties is obligated to act in a reasonable fashion.
Well, the paraphrase may be misleading. What I've said is that very common, the lease will almost always wind up to say, except it's expressly set forth elsewhere in a particular instance, any time that a party's consent or approval is required, that party shall not unreasonably withhold, delay, or condition its consent or approval. That's the way it winds up when that doesn't appear in the lease globally, right? Then a responsible attorney seeing the lease for the first time needs to add that phrase either globally or needs to add that space place in 22 places in the lease. And as long as we're going to talk about reasonable, I also think that when a party is obligated to pay money to the other party, such as if I repair it because you didn't, you're going to pay me for the cost of repair, then any time that a party is obligated to pay money like that, they should only pay what was reasonable and necessary. And there should be a provision that they're going to pay it within a period of time, 20 days or whatever, after receipt of a bill that contains reasonable evidence of the charges. Because that's the way it ought to be.
So, Ira, you're stealing my thunder.
Howard, you Howard, are... then you go right ahead. I will be reasonable.
I want to talk a little bit about.
Can I weigh in, or do you want to?
Joel, I'd like you to
insert.
Well, okay. I think what you suggested and what Ira suggested, we've seen that lots of times. We've seen a clause buried at the back of the lease that says whenever consent or approval is required, it has to be reasonable. And I've seen it in the reverse, where it's unless otherwise provided, it has to be reasonable. Unless otherwise provided, it will be deemed to be sole discretion. Okay? What that means is you got to go back in the 22 places where you feel that reasonableness needs to be stated or sole discretion needs to be stated. And I don't really have a problem with that. It makes a little extra work. I don't think the blanket statement really should cover every subject in the lease. There are cases where, as long as the parties are acting in good faith, the party can exercise sole discretion consent. Being unreasonable is a subjective thing. It's not equated with bad faith. Bad faith is something worse.
Being unreasonable is an objective standard. We're not talking about personal satisfaction. The word
unreasonable. Unreasonable is subjective. Reasonable is objective.
If you got to a court, if there were a dispute and you got to a court, the court would apply an objective standard, not
yes.
what this particular party believes, unless they reserve the right for personal satisfaction. And so
right.
the word reasonable is replete in court cases. It's replete in all kinds of agreements. It's not a nebulous word. It is a word that the world has come to understand, just as the word material is a word come to understand. Our statutes are loaded with it. Our cases are loaded with it. Our documents are loaded with it. It is not an amorphous, what-do-I-think kind of thing. And you know
I never said
now,
it was, but unreasonableness.
You.
Yeah, go ahead.
No, wait. I do. I do. I'm the one who goes into court and has to prove what reasonable is or isn't. And the way that I go about proving it is to bring in experts who will say what is reasonable, and then the court makes its determination. The problem is each side brings in their own experts who give differing opinions. So it's very...
What you're saying, what I hear you saying, Howard, is it's not subjective, it's objective. The court is looking to experts to say what the community, what society deems to be reasonable, not what the individual party deems to be reasonable. That's an objective standard.
That's correct. But
I think we're all in agreement on
also,
the fact that reasonable means is objective.
Yeah, we just want to disagree for the. Yeah, we just want to disagree for the fun of it. But yeah, honestly, when I've represented a tenant, I have used the exact language that Ira has recommended, because I'll go through it and say, look, most of the time, the consent or any action is usually an action that as tenant I'm wanting the landlord to make. So I'm going to have to go to the landlord, and I'm going to want the landlord to act reasonably. So I add language, except as otherwise expressly contained herein to the contrary, everything that the landlord's supposed to do is reasonable. Of course, I'm paraphrasing it a bit. And that way, I think that's just simply because of I represent the tenant, I think that's good drafting, so you don't have to go through 22 provisions in the lease. And I mean, this goes back to a time where I didn't have a computer, and I didn't want to go looking for it and be fearful of the fact that I might have missed one that I should have got.
Well, I can understand that, especially okay. since you have to continue to dip that quill in the inkwell.
Yeah.
That's 10 years of the practice, then. Yeah.
Okay, well, I think, I think we're basically all in agreement about the use of the word reasonable.
So let me
yes.
ask you something in terms of while we're on this subject, because I'm not
yes.
sure where it's come out. What do you think about the provision found in landlord form leases? I don't think I've seen a tenant form lease, which says that our only liability for being unreasonable is that you can go to court. And if the court says we're unreasonable, then you can have your consent. But we have no other liability to you. And I would say, and I didn't make that clause up. And
right.
I will remind you, before you answer, I'll remind you of some great Supreme Court justice, Howard probably knew him, who said to play us to the knock.
Okay. What do I think of that clause?
Yeah.
I think it stinks.
Okay, so I would ask you, is it a legitimate discussion? Is that the kind of provision that should be in any lease? Not that it isn't, and everything's bargaining power, but do you think that we would save a lot of angst if we did start out with clauses like that? That are only imposed on the small tenant with no bargaining power, who's not going to be found after they breach the lease anyway?
No, I don't agree. I don't think that should be a starting point for which the tenant then has to whittle away with exceptions. I think what I have seen, I've seen that clause. I've seen it applied in the limited to the assignment context, and then I've also seen it applied in the general context. And I don't agree. I think it's a really unfair provision, and I don't agree with it across the board. You know, if you apply it in the assignment context, by the time you go to court with your seeking equitable relief, which is supposed to be expeditious, you've lost your deal, and so you've won nothing. And the landlord knows this. And I think the possibility of being exposed to damages for acting unreasonably when he's supposed to be reasonable, I think is something that should be in the lease to make the parties behave, because there's no incentive otherwise for the landlord to be reasonable, because all the tenant could do with that clause is sue him, and by the time he wins, he's lost his deal or whatever reason he was asking for consent to. So
for the landlord,
well,
what's
no, but the question is, what I thought was, what's balanced? You want to know what gets the lease done. That doesn't get the lease done quicker.
Well,
that
let me
slows
ask
it
this
down.
Question about that, the side effect of that.
Yeah.
So, Joel, either you or I or Howard or Sally or Jane or someone has a client whose form lease has that provision in it.
Mm-hmm.
And the tenant's attorney says, no, this is, to delay it to deny, this is absolutely inappropriate. It's really inequitable. Never mind unfair, it's inequitable. And it really doesn't belong here. And you and I share that feeling in general, you know.
Yeah.
Still, we share that feeling. And then we feel compelled to defend it because we don't want to tell our own client that this clause is an impediment to getting the deal done quickly, to getting the rent coming in earlier, to get the tenant punching the cash register sooner. And you and I, if we were on this deal and I were trying to defend this clause, you would be angry at me. You wouldn't trust anything I had to say after that. You would think that everything I was, all my arguments after that would be contrived, even though I've never contrived an argument. And you would be...
I absolutely
disagree. As do I, but go ahead, Howard.
Right.
If I had that language in one of my landlord leases, 95% of the time, with the tenants in the leases that we deal with, 95% of the time, no one's going to even look at it or comment upon it. And if you walked in representing a national tenant and said, you know, we don't want this, I'd probably say fine.
You know,
you must have read
a comment to last week's blog piece where one of the commenters legitimately wrote and said, you know, Ira, you're wrong about starting where the lease will wind up, because sometimes the other side won't see it or won't complain about it, and then I will have a got you. And that's what the lease negotiation process is about. And by the way, I don't attack the comment, because even though I disagree with it, I think it reflects the view of a significant minority of people who negotiate leases. They think that it's a game and not an economic bargain between parties, each of whom wants to make money out of the deal. But that's I think what you've stated is in fact an attitude that is detrimental to getting deals done.
Well, I don't see it as a game having language in there. My job is to put my client in the best position possible. And, you know, and I also deal with these things 8, 9, 10, 12, 15 years down the road. And all of a sudden, I have to deal with this language going, oh, too bad
too
we didn't
bad
have that
we,
language in there. We'd be in a much stronger position.
We weren't able to be the parent, in this case, for this infant tenant, that we can tell the tenant, you'll do it the way I want to do it because.
Right. Well, that's part of what I call behaving badly. You know, to your point or your question, Ira, about, let's say you're representing a landlord and the form lease which you inherited, and they want you to put that lease out there, says whenever the landlord's consent or approval is required, or, you know, all the tenant could do is seek an injunction in the event it doesn't think it's the landlord's being reasonable. You know, the idea of like, well, what's the worst thing that can happen to the landlord? But what? And now I'm representing the landlord, and I'm supposed to defend that position. All right, I do not sympathize with that position. That's hard to defend. So I would do very, very diplomatically say to my client, are you sure you want to pursue this? Because there are instances where it's a little overbroad and it's a little too burdensome. And
sure.
And what do you think? And I said, I'll do whatever you want, client. I'll do whatever you want, but here are my views, and that's what you pay me for. And he says, no, I still want you to do it and go out there and you know, carry the standards. And that's what I would do. I'd say my client insists on it.
But the consequence is you have corrupted the bargaining process in getting the lease done. Because...
I can't go against my own client, so how is it corrupting?
I understand you can't go against your own client. We, in negotiating leases, attorney or non-attorney, we are agents. We have a duty to the principal, to the property owner, or the tenant. We understand that. I'm suggesting that where we have the ability to influence the outcome, to influence our client, after we've established trust and so forth, I think it would be wise for us to let our clients know that you can't micromanage everything if you want to get deals done and you want to start off as if you're getting married as opposed to as if you were getting divorced. I agree.
Prerequisite
for a divorce and marriage.
Ira, I got to interrupt you. Take a breath. I know that you're enjoying the Southern California weather. I need you to take a breath so that Roger can have people hear from the people who pay our bills around here. So, Roger, please, get me out of here for a second.
If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. What's next for commercial real estate and retail marketing? Pop-up retail, and it's here now. PopUpInsider.com is the premier online resource for owners to advertise and fill properties for temporary use. PopUpInsider.com is where merchants and brands shop for temporary locations. See for yourself. Go to PopUpInsider.com, create your own account, market your empty spaces, or view available locations for your business. All on one convenient site, PopUpInsider.com. Here's an exciting new tool for brokers and investors, RateBlend. RateBlend is a powerful online rent calculator that's quick and easy to use. Print and send detailed, effective rent analyses with a single click. RateBlend is easy to read, so what does your spreadsheet mean goes away. As a web app, RateBlend is accessible from your computer or any mobile device. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Andrew Bermudez, and links to RateBlend. Try it today. This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guest, please call 619 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Welcome back to CRE Radio. I'm your host, Howard Klein, and I'm here with Ira Meslick and Joel Hall. You know, guys, we could talk for hours upon hours and upon hours, so excuse me if I'm kind of moving you along a little bit. We should probably do a marathon for about 6 to 8
no
hours for the three of us. If I might, I'd like to get on to a couple of the other specific instances and suggestions that Ira has come up with, one of which is, I think this was what he's saying here, no default unless there's a notice of default, explaining in reasonable detail the nature of the alleged default. He then goes on to suggest upon the cure of any such default, the party asserting the right shall be afforded that or the right that would otherwise have been impaired. So I have to actually think that one out. And then it goes on to say, and he talks about this, that wherever a party has an obligation to pay or reimburse the other for a non-scheduled item, such as base rental or periodic payments of operating expenses or taxes. Guys, I can hear you in the background. Such payment shall be due and payable 20 days after the obligated party has received proper billing therefor. So, to me, as a landlord, that's not even a starter. That is a non-starter.
Why, Howard? Why?
Well, because as a landlord, I want you to pay your rent on time. I don't want to have to go out and rely upon property managers who may or may not be on top of their game. And then, I mean, this tends to escalate the delays in
Howard,
getting paid.
Either I wrote it wrong or you've read it wrong. This addresses, other than periodic obligations, this is not rent or additional rent, things which have a fixed date on which they're due. Those have a fixed date and the consequences of whatever the rest of the lease says. This has to do with non-periodic charges where the landlord sends a bill to the tenant for a utility because the tenant doesn't know how much the bill is going to be till they get it. And I'm saying, is that when you have leases, commonly do not provide a period for payment. They may even say that all these payments are due whenever the next rent is due, which means if I receive the bill on the 30th of the month, right, it would mean I have to pay it the next day or the second day after that. I'm saying is that rather than mark up the lease on you put here and here and here, I'm suggesting that the lease ought to say that when you're going to pay something based on a bill, right, that the tenant has to receive the bill or the landlord has to receive the bill, depending on which way it's going. It has to be a proper bill, and then it's payable within 20 days. Why do we have to spend 20 minutes in a negotiation over making that change?
I agree with Ira on that.
Yeah, I agree with Ira on that. Unfortunately, he wrote it wrong on the article because I went back and I double-checked it 3 times. I'm going, you sure you mean that base rent or periodic payments are non-scheduled? So with that correction, I couldn't agree with you more. From my perspective, no, I send you a bill. I got to give you time to pay the bill. It shouldn't have to be due in one day.
Why did you leave say otherwise?
All right.
We heard something in the background.
I'm sorry. All right. what I'm saying is I agree with Ira's language. I'll go further than to just apply it to non-recurring charges. I'd even apply it to the minimum rent, which everyone knows is due on the first day of the month. But mistakes happen, even with big companies, you know, even with computer-generated checks. Mistakes happen. And unless they're told that you didn't get it, you know, it doesn't get fixed. And that's why I don't think that should even be a discussion. I think Ira's language should do it. I mean,
I disagree. If you owe, there are some unlawful detainer statutory provisions in California that reference, you know, when you can serve a 3-day notice, and it says you can only send a 3-day notice after there's a default. And it, and I have argued that, well, gosh, if your lease says that there's no default until after you give 10 days notice, I can't even serve a 3-day notice until after I've given a non-statutory 10-day notice saying that you're in default and you're not going to be in default.
And most leases say that they run concurrently with any statutory period.
By the way,
most leases that you work.
The posting at retailrealestatelaw.com last week was addressed to this issue about default notices. It's not shameless. I have no problem with shame. My contention is that landlords always send notices. We attorneys and other negotiators pretend that we shouldn't have to send a notice. If the landlord wants to get the rent, it picks up the phone, it sends a notice. There's a point at which it does, in which it just overburdens it. But the reality is, if a tenant is paying the rent every month, pretty close to the first of the month, to the fifth, to the eighth, every month, 30-day intervals, the landlords don't care. They use these provisions selectively for other reasons. And I would suggest
Absolutely.
That Joel is saying is that if you don't get the rent, okay, it's probably because I didn't send it, but it might be because I sent it and you didn't get it. I won't know that you didn't get it. Just give me a notice. And I think we should be distinguishing between defaults and breaches, small d defaults and small b breaches, and something called an event of default. An event of default should be the trigger for whatever the remedies are, or whatever the conditions are. But to suggest that every minor transgression by either side is a default that triggers the remedies in a lease that are based on being a default, I think is shameful. No, I don't think shameful. I think it's wrong. I think it's wrong, and I do believe that leases wind up with an obligation for a landlord that it is not an event of default unless the landlord has not received the rent within 10 days after a notice is sent or notice is received that the rent was due and unpaid. And the reality is that when I hear somebody say to me, we can't keep track of that and the like, I'm going to suggest that if I were to open your file cabinet, Mr. Person, Ms. Person on the other side, I will find an abundant number of leases that require you to give notice, right? And that answer is contrived because you haven't thought it through. But I'm too kind to say that, but that's what goes through my head. And I lose a little regard for the people on the other side. And then I get angry, and then you call me doing this stuff. You're an angry guy.
Yeah, so I'll bring boxing gloves to any negotiation you and I have. Joel, what are your comments?
No, I actually agree 100% with what I was saying. You know, not just because it's just right. I mean, you're right. You don't use the word shame. There's right. I mean, there's basic common sense, and what's right is, you know, what's right is right, and what's not is not. And I think everyone has a basic sense of that. And the guys that argue with me, the landlord lawyers, you know the rent is due. I don't want to have to send you notice. And they start whining like that. Ira's right. The guy, that's BS. And I do lose respect for the person, although I'd never in polite conversation say that. Nor would I amp up my tone into a hostile zone. I just would listen, but I know what's going on, and I only wish the other guy knew that I knew what's going on. So I just argue the usual old, tired old argument. Well, we can make a mistake, and on Friday night, then the checks were sitting on somebody's desk, and the maid came along and inadvertently swept it into the wastebasket, and the tenant never knew that it did not get mailed on Monday morning. I mean, stuff happens.
Okay.
Right.
There's what's written, and then
But how much time do I have to spend lecturing the landlord's lawyer about simple common sense?
Well, you don't have to spend any time. I mean, ultimately, when we get to the end of the show, the bottom line is going to be, look, we really don't have to spend a bunch of time if you have knowledgeable and experienced people negotiating the lease. And I will say, let me tell you that in my experience with, I don't know, maybe thousands of leases at this point in time, that landlords are notorious. Commercial landlords are notorious for not holding the tenant's feet to the fire. So if it says the, you know, your rent is due on the first of the month, nobody, and they shouldn't, make a big deal that the rent isn't paid exactly on the first of the month. Most landlords, frankly, will go a couple of months, which is wrong, before they even make a big deal about it. And I will say that there's only one exception that I have seen to that. And that is when I was general counsel in the 80s. And we signed a three-floor lease in a high-rise in Detroit. And the lease started, and, you know, our finance department sent out a payment, and the landlord received it on the fifth day of the month. On the second day of the month, I received a three-day notice. And I'm going, well, what's going on? So we paid it. Yeah, I mean, it was like it
pretext.
Was automatic. It must have been
pretext.
Huh? Yeah, you know. And so that happened for 2 or 3 months, and I'm calling up the landlord going, what are you doing? He says, no, you're going to have to pay a late fee. I want you to pay on the first of the month. And so eventually I just said, I went to our accounts receivable department or payable department, and I just said, look, guys, would you pay this? Schedule this on the 20th day of the month. And we made the adjustment.
Yeah, as long as and thereafter, if you got it at 30-day intervals, you're in the same place. All right.
You know,
yeah.
It isn't that big a deal.
It isn't
that big a deal, but it is the attitude. In this past week's blog, I talk about the propriety of late fees. I mean, I think they're appropriate.
Yeah.
I think they're appropriate with proper balance. I think they're appropriate. The game we play that they're not a penalty is a foolish game, because they're really there to inspire tenants to pay their rent on time. But on time in this world, the non-Puritan world, means about the first of the month. I confess, I pay my rent on the 25th of the month, every month, 5 days ahead of the first, and have always done that. I did get a letter from my landlord after 7 or 8 years of this saying, I think you missed the month's rent, and I said, go back and look and see that I actually paid in advance, and he came down to see me, and he said, you know what, I came to see you because we've never had a tenant pay the rent on time, and we assumed because your rent was coming on the 26th or 27th, you were running a month late. I apologize.
Oh, okay. I think the late charge is really intended for the chronic offender. Let me just give you an example. I had a client,
yes.
National chain client. The monthly rent was $100,000 a month. It was a big property in New York City. $100,000 a month rent. And there was a 10% late charge if the tenant didn't pay on the due date. All right? And we had a really mean landlord. And what happened is the client's computer went crazy, and it issued a check. In 2 months in succession, it issued a check in the amount of one penny payable to the landlord. I mean, that was a pure computer glitch. And don't you know that that landlord charged $10,000, which is 10% of the late fee, 2 months in succession, which really it really encouraged the tenant to get its IT department to fix this, because that was ridiculous. But the landlord on the other side getting a check for one penny, he had to know there was something wrong, that the tenant did not intend to do that. All right. So
unless he thought fair rental value of the space.
Not in New York City. No. All right.
You know, you're in practice, the landlords that I represent, they never really charge the late fee unless the tenant becomes chronic, and then it then comes to my office, and then I go ahead and I say, okay, you owe this, and you owe all these late fees that we've now calculated. But you're right, Joel. As a practical matter, again, you know, something like that is just, I mean, you got to live with each other, so you shouldn't be a jerk about it, but they're going to be. Guys, why don't we take a few minute break, and when we come back, I'd like to talk about the word good faith, which Ira had used. So why don't we take a break right now?
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. tacticsmagazine.com.
Techniques Marketing can help you do more business with your biggest clients. We've developed exciting ways to increase your revenue streams with your key accounts, way beyond mere trial and error. And we've done it for some of the biggest companies in America. If you're happy with your numbers, great. If not, we should talk. Techniques Marketing, TECH, that's the tech, NIQUES, there you've got your Neeks, TechniquesMarketing.com.
This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Okay, welcome back to CRE Radio. We're here with Joel Hull and Ira Mislick. And I just want to remind everybody that if you want to make a comment, leave a comment for us on our website, go to http://creradio.com/the lease, or leave a comment on Twitter at using the @CRE Radio. Okay, guys, so let's talk a little bit about good faith in the lease. Ira had suggested in his article, this may be the exact word, wherever a party has reserved the right to act using its own discretion or judgment, or to apply a similar standard, that party shall act in good faith and in a commercially reasonable manner. If a party has reserved the right to act in its sole discretion, or to use its sole judgment, or to apply a similar standard, that party must still act in good faith. And I probably, you know, there are instances, particularly in California, where a landlord may have a justifiable reason to act in its own discretion. There may be all kinds of other reasons, and there are also, in California, reasons not to.
Well, Howard,
there are reasons also not to leave everything up to the landlord. Doesn't want to have everything in its own discretion. But the problem I have is the second part of the sentence, where even where it's left up to the sole discretion of the landlord, that the landlord must still act in good faith. And I think that that's almost...
No, I don't think... I disagree. I think there's a difference between unreasonable, which generally means subjective preference, and bad faith. Everything that's done in bad faith is also unreasonable, but the reverse is not true. Every action of a landlord that may be subjective, think of unreasonable as equal to the word subjective, is not necessarily made in bad faith. And you can apply that in the assignment context. You could apply that in the context. Ira wrote an article about should a landlord have the right to review the tenant's fit out in the premises. And I would say that that a landlord could, very with justification, in a case like that, say, my sole discretion consent is required for certain issues. That still means he has to act in good faith, so that if his sole discretion says that I do not want all these extra columns in my space that you, tenant, propose to put in, that he's giving a subjective opinion. It may not, okay, it's unreasonable in the sense that it's sole discretion, but is he acting in good bad faith? No, not at all. And there is a distinct bright line between the two.
So we speak law.
Ira,
the covenant of good faith and fair dealing is implied in every contract, possibly in some states with the exception of employment agreements. So there is already the implied covenant. The good faith is not that nebulous. The most objective statement of good faith commonly used is in the Uniform Commercial Code, where good faith is defined as meaning solely honesty in fact and the observance of reasonable commercial standards of fair dealing. So honesty in fact is the core to both the UCC and to what the law of common law applies, that when a landlord says, I don't want the columns in my space, if the landlord is being honest in fact because that will have a detrimental effect on the landlord, then the landlord has made a call in good faith. But if the landlord says, I'm willing to have these columns if the tenant will pay me $5,000 more a month,
right?
And I'm going to tell the tenant that I don't want the space cut up because it will affect my repair obligations or whatever it may be, right? If the landlord's not being honest, it's breach of duty of good faith. It's not that the decision is subject to countermand by somebody else who might have thought otherwise. And so,
that's right.
I mean, that's the law.
So I think Ira and I are saying it's not an oxymoron, Howard. I think
Well, I'm not sure that I entirely agree on that. Let me ask you this question, Ira. I'm not sure I understand what you mean by honest in fact. I mean, to me, that sounds more like what the landlord's reasoning is as he's expressed it.
Well, I'm going to suggest that I was not on the drafting committee for the Uniform Commercial Code. I don't sit on their permanent editorial board. I know folks who do, but it doesn't make me that much smarter. This is the law with respect to far more transactions than there are leases. Right? It, except in the law, the case law has it, it's 51 jurisdictions. That's a universal definition, and it, in fact, it's a restricted definition. It's more restricted than a common law. The notion of good faith is part and parcel of the fabric of the law. When what happens is that our colleagues don't know this, and they want to defend, they want to take the position that sole discretion, right, or way I write it, way Joel writes, a lot of other people write it, is the landlord may deny its consent to any reason or no reason at all. That takes the word discretion out. Any reason or no reason at all, there's still an obligation of good faith. I think the lease ought to put that in the face of the landlord or in the face of the tenant because it goes both ways. So you don't have to have a discussion about what the law is. Let the parties see right in there that they have an obligation of good faith. And it is not a nebulous term.
Well,
it's so universal.
Can we translate that in a way that the non-lawyers can understand it?
It's almost big. It's almost a common sense thing, Howard. I don't know if you can define,
Well, I think we could give an example. Let me tell you what what I've got in mind. A perfect example, excuse me, is a situation in which the landlord does not have to use its reasonable discretion. It can act in its absolute and sole discretion. But there's still the covenant of good faith and fair dealing. And in an issue of an assignment and subletting, let's take it outside of the state of California, which has special rules that relate to the landlord's discretion on assignment of subletting. But you can, there's one issue where there's some basis for the landlord to make a decision versus, say, the basis of extorting additional rent from the tenant. I think it would be the landlord would be acting in bad faith if the sole and only possible reason would be to extort another $10,000 a month or whatever.
Well, I would. Go ahead, Ira. Go ahead.
There are a whole bunch of cases about good faith. There's a Sons of Thunder in New Jersey is a seminal case. But basically, the implied covenant of good faith is a presumption that the parties will deal with each other honestly, fairly, and in good faith so as not to destroy the right of the other party or the parties to receive the benefit of the bargain. There's imbued outside of the words. It is, the paper itself has absorbed the notion that people are entitled to the benefit of their bargain and that one will not wheedle and take away the fundamental bargain that people have entered into the agreement to begin with. So honesty, fairness, and not doing something to take away the benefit of the bargain is what contract law means as good faith. The UCC has refined that to be honesty in fact. But it's a bona fide reason, not an extortive reason. And as long as it's a bona fide reason, not intended to destroy the other party, then discretion is done in good faith. I think, I don't know how to explain it because I'm not a layperson.
No, I think that's fine. Let me ask you this, Ira, in this kind. Let me, a very common art of...
He's a good faith, a guy as they get.
Yeah, that's right. One of the most common arguments I get into in around the assignment clause is the turning over of the bonus value of a lease. If a tenant wants to assign and the market value rent is now higher than the lease rent, and the landlord wants it all. And forget the fact that everyone agrees to split it 50-50 after you take certain expenses. Let me finish, Ira. Let me finish. Now, just when the landlord says, I will, and let's say the lease is silent on this. I mean, there are provisions that says the landlord can take this, but let's say the lease says nothing. And the tenant comes and for consent, the landlord says, okay, I see your deal. I see your rent $10 and you're collecting 15. I want the whole $5 if you want me to approve this. Now, I think that that's, if the lease is silent, I think that's unreasonable, and I think the courts have held that to be so. Do you also agree that it is bad faith, Ira?
It's bad faith. It's not a question of being unreasonable. It's unreasonable because it's in bad faith because the bargain was that the tenant owns that space during the term of the lease.
Exactly.
You're wrapping back to the beginning of the show. When the lease, and we see many of them, say that the landlord is going to take 100%, we all know that if the landlord is going to get any part of the profit, and that's bargaining power, it's only going to be 50%. And I'm going to suggest the following. Right? I don't know, I've spent not countless hours, but too many hours talking to people on the other side and who were defending 100%, and I say, look, here's your example, Howard. The tenant's paying $10, it fines a subtenant for $15 for the entire space. The landlord wants the whole $5. Do you know if the landlord insists on that, you know what I say? I tell you what, I'm going to let the subtenant pay $10. If I have no incentive to extract extract extra money for this space because you're going to take it all. Why did I knock myself out looking, making it a hard find to find a subtenant? I'll just give the subtenant a bargain. They'll do a line around the block.
Right, but it is stupid.
The other side defends it, and I have no respect for the other side. And by the way, they have no respect for me because if they don't accept my argument, then they think that I'm the one who's, like, off the wall, and we have no respect for each other.
Yeah, you're in the retail business. I'm in the real estate business. That's the refrain I always hear.
I hear all that. I disagree with that, but that's a matter of bargaining power. I'm saying, yes, you're in real estate. I'll concede for this discussion. You're in real estate business. I'm in the retail business. I won't go down the philosophy and so forth. But do you understand that if you want 100%, you'll always get nothing?
Yes, that's right. That's right.
Find somebody.
That's why you wind up with the sharing.
That's a good argument.
To get as much in the market from a subtenant, and I'll share it with you after I take certain costs off the top.
So why do
that's
we have
how
to
it
have
winds up.
Why does the lease have to start out at 100%?
I agree with you. It doesn't. It should start out with the end position.
That becomes another whole philosophy. Guys, let's take one last break and hear from some more of our sponsors, and then we will try to wrap this up as I had suggested in the beginning. And one of the things that I'd like to talk about is, you know, having this language, trying to come up with boilerplate language that everybody's going to agree to, is that really practical, or are there other ways to try to? I really don't know what the answer is, and I'm going to put this out and we'll talk about it. Are there other ways that we could better try to streamline the negotiation process? So we'll be back in a few minutes.
Manage a shopping center? Always looking for new ideas? Tactics. Tactics Magazine is the idea magazine for shopping center marketing directors all over the world. Exciting promotions, gift with purchase programs, and full-blown ad campaigns. Every edition of Tactics is packed with features, ideas, and news you can use to get the word out and grow your numbers. How can you manage a shopping center without your tactics? Log on to tacticsmagazine.com. Today would be good. tacticsmagazine.com. Go mobile with the analyst. When the deal changes, and you know it will, be ready whenever, wherever, to update property analyses with the analyst. Multi-page reports in seconds sent straight from your mobile device to your client's email. Environmental summaries delivered right to your iPhone or iPad in as little as 10 minutes. Free from your desk at last with the analyst. Log on to creradio.com for Howard's comments, his one-on-one with developer Todd Kuhlman, and links to the analyst. If you're a retail tenant, you really should belong to the NRTA. They're an organization of the tenants, by the tenants, and for the tenants. Whether you manage a large portfolio or just a mom and pop, the National Retail Tenants Association is on your side. NRTA exists to protect retail tenants everywhere and to make sure landlord billings are correct. Don't wait for your next statement of CAM charges to arrive. Log on to retailtenants.org. That's retailtenants.org. Find out more today. This is Commercial Real Estate Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a comment for Howard or his guests, please call 619-393-6492. That's area 619-393-6492. Then press 1 to be placed in queue.
Okay, so Ira has suggested that we come up with some boilerplate language that, Ira would consider to be fair and reasonable to both sides. And of course, the problem that I have is that I don't think everybody's going to agree with Ira. Probably that comes as a surprise to you, Ira, but you might have to just go with me on this. What are some of the other things that you know, people can do to streamline the negotiation process. And I've already given you an outline of some of the thoughts that I had, because I'm not so sure that the language in a boilerplate is necessarily going to make things easier. But I'd be willing to certainly try that. So what else can you rely upon?
You have outlined there, Howard, the first thing under 3A you said in your outline, a thorough LOI containing the business terms. I agree with that 100%, provided both sides honor it, except in good faith instances where there was a mistake that should be honored, and no lawyer should try to deviate and depart from the LOI. And I've even advocated that more go into the LOI, like assignment provisions and some other things, to try and speed it up at the front end of the deal so that we don't have to get them right. Okay.
Right. I couldn't agree with you more. And the problem that I have is that too often I get LOIs that are inadequate, leaving too much up to me.
Or too much up for grabs. And that's what slows it all down. The other thing is, you also say, and I'll jump off here, is that better training of brokers and attorneys as well as the parties. If you have an experienced real estate person working in partnership with an experienced lease negotiating lawyer, you'll find how much more quickly deals will get done. And you don't bring the ego games and the emotional baggage to the table that gets involved in some of these negotiations. You're just sitting there. At the end of the day, it's a real estate deal. And there's no need to bring all that extra yelling, screaming, emotional baggage into this, you know. And I find that with the more sophisticated, educated professionals, brokers and lawyers, you don't get into that. You don't just devolve into that. You get the deal. You know, the deals move much more quickly. That's what it is.
I like to focus on what's in the control of the negotiators, that we can work with our principals, our clients, bosses, and so forth, to try to get, you know, the deal more defined ahead of time. There's a balance between comprehensive deal sheets and getting the deal moving. But in terms of our own behavior, I think that the telephone remains a very useful tool, and that people are hiding behind email. That sometimes if you pick up the phone and go over the primary issues, not the little stuff that you wait to see in writing, go over the primary issues, you can shortcut the process. But I think that more and more of us are falling back out of laziness or fear or whatever, and I'm going to pick up the phone and say, hey, look, let's go over the 7 or 8 things in here. Let's talk about this assignment language. My client needs to be able to sell its business. That's its exit strategy. They're going to retire and get old and sell the business. We need a provision in here that's going to allow them to do it without the landlord becoming part of my client's business. Can we work that out? Because if the answer is no, we don't care. We don't care about your client's need for its own business, because we're in the real estate business and you're in the tenant business. We're saying, yeah, okay, you're in the real estate business, but we're in the business of retiring. And you can't do that efficiently by sending back proposed language to ping pong games. So I think using the telephone is really very helpful, and over time, people have backed away from that.
Well, I agree with the personal element is important, and before the days of email, Ira, you will certainly remember that meeting face-to-face was better than the telephone because people were hiding behind the telephone. But It's not feasible today. You just can't go flying across the country for every negotiation. But I do agree with you. I do agree. Negotiating by email is not a good way to get this deal done.
The negotiations shouldn't be. As a matter of fact, I agree with both of you, is the actual negotiations should be the personal or over the telephone. The email is simply to be used for
transmitting documents.
Making sure that transmitting documents or making sure that the language in the lease accurately reflects what everybody agreed to. That's all. So you agree to something on the telephone and then the document. So, yeah, you know, when we draft things, someone might not feel that it's quite accurate and covers all of the issues that you were concerned about when you talked about it. But that's...
Well, let's agree on the principle. There's another item, and then the other is that I don't think that those of us who negotiating leases think that we are the beginning and the end of the process. If the landlord and tenant are sophisticated, experienced people, when it comes to genuine business issues that come up in the course, a bullet point, here are six business issues, they will talk with each other. When you have people who have less experience, generally the tenants, but people who have less experience, I think the role of a qualified commercial broker is irreplaceable.
I agree. And I
believe that hubris among negotiators, and more so among attorney negotiators and non-attorney negotiators, but it's not exclusive, just bars many of us from letting the brokers handle the business issue when the principals are not as capable. And so each of us, we're gladiators, and I think that attitude is wrong, but we should use it to not have disrespect for the brokers and vice versa for whatever. It's just so destructive to the process.
Yeah, I think brokers see lawyers as in the way of the deal, you know, and even the brokers, the experienced brokers I've seen, that even though their compensation is based on getting the deal done and they get a percentage of that, I've seen them stand up and do the right thing and take a position, let's say, in support of the tenant's position, even though it'll put the conclusion of the deal back a little further in time because they're doing the right thing. And that comes from experience. And I would that there were more, that I saw more in that real estate community and the legal community that had more experience under their belt. And that can only come with experience.
Joel, you touch on something else. And that is, if you don't know something, it's not wrong to say, I don't know, let me think about that, let me find out.
Absolutely.
But too many of us defend things because we don't understand them. And that can very well be, I mean, it typically comes up in areas that people don't understand, mundane things like the insurance provisions. If I tell you that there is no such thing as an all-risk insurance policy, it hasn't been available since 1983 when the form was eliminated because it never protected against all risks, and the courts used to look at the title and say, okay, you have to.
Yeah, yeah, yeah.
1983. Now, what is that, 30 years ago? And the lease is still called for all-risk insurance, and when you say to somebody that's not the wrong term and they don't understand it, they defend it. All our leases say that. That's what we need to have. And that tells me that you're dealing with somebody who doesn't have the confidence to say, you know, I didn't know that. It comes to surprise me to check on that.
Yeah, they bring an ego issue to the table. They got an eggshell sensitivity. And I'd be the first one, and I've done this many times. You know what? I really don't understand that. In fact, that's something new on me. Let me think about that, or let me talk to my people about that. No shame in that. You gain somebody's respect that way. Not the reverse.
That's experience.
You've never seen that as a response, at least twice a week.
Oh. What do you mean? The negative response?
I'm an experienced negotiator. I went to law school, or I went to, you know, clean press and alteration school. I went to CPA, and don't tell me, because I know you're wrong. You know, somebody said, I think you're wrong. My answer is, you know, I don't think so. But let me check. You must have a good reason. Wrong?
Huh? Ira, have you never done that yourself? Never.
That's why I've learned. I used to
in my earlier career I did the same thing. Okay, but I was coming from a place of less confidence than I had now, only because I put the mileage on, and after a while, you get comfortable, and you know what you're doing, and you're comfortable with yourself that you can say to the other side, I don't understand what you just said.
So the problem is dealing with a young version of you.
Yes, that's right.
Or me.
Well, it's not
right.
Youth. It's not youth alone. Because there are self people like this too.
Yes, that's true.
Sure.
That's true. Look at Howard. But you know, it's
no, not that old.
You
not
look at
old.
Howard.
Yeah.
No, it takes
well,
a personal
guys,
maturity. I think on that score is what it is.
Getting to the point where you have made so many mistakes that you realize that you're going to make so many more.
One day, Joel, I will be there, Howard.
Yeah.
All right, guys. Listen, I'm going to have to wrap this up. I'd like to thank both of you. This was a really, really good discussion. Very casual. I hope it was informative for everyone. It frankly, from my perspective, and I haven't even had the time to break in and discuss on some of these other issues, including the good faith issue. But I know that what I'm going to do is I'm going to sit down and look a little bit more into it and get back to Ira so that I can insist that he's wrong, or most likely kind of agree that he's right, but carve out a little exception. That'll make me feel
better. Howard, I know you don't have time, but what you want to tell me is you want the right to act in bad faith. Yeah, okay.
That's right.
Now you know
absolutely
how these negotiations go.
That's right. I was right on
now,
with that. Yeah.
Now you know me. Yeah, now you know me, and now you know why my landlord clients like me. If anybody would like to get in touch with either Ira or Joel, their contact information will be found on our website. Do either of you have any speaking engagements or appearances?
Well, I do. This is Joel. I'm on the advisory board for the Georgetown Advanced Commercial Leasing Program, and that program is happening April 3rd to April 5th at Georgetown Law School in Washington. And it's an advanced program. They still have openings for it for lawyers that have been out 10 years or more. It deals with leasing issues at a very higher level. I'm like honored to be on the board, so I'm going to be doing a presentation regarding assignment and subletting, along with my two co-panelists. Yeah.
I'm not going to tout my schedule, but some of my written materials will be used at the Georgetown Symposium.
Ah, okay.
Ah, you didn't know that, did you?
Very good. Well, we ought to get some more of that. Well, other than the radio show, gosh, I've got quite a few appearances, one of which is I'm going to be speaking at the there's a large IRIM conference in Anaheim at the end of May, and we're working on a couple of other speaking engagements for me. Our next show is called A Cold Calling Day in Hell with Rod Santamassimo and Mike Dernerin. And we're going to talk quite a lot about cold calling for brokers and perhaps some tricks, but the philosophy of trying to get it done. We've got a show where we've set up that's going to be March 1st, March 29th. We've got the Architectural Copyright Protections and Liabilities with Jeff Reichert. Very interesting discussion on protecting the design of buildings, and even knowing that there was some sort of copyright protection for the design of buildings. We've got another show with about the commercial real estate job market with Bob Poline, and we've got a show on using electronic signatures in commercial real estate, one of my favorite shows. We also have a show we're just about to schedule it, Green Buildings and the Value of Sustainability. And we have three guests for that, one of whom is David Pogue.
Oh.
We've just signed up two other guests, one from, I think, the head of sustainability for Kimco. And I've got I'm going to be embarrassed. I will edit this to include the gentleman from NYU who does a whole bunch of sustainability work. I was just told earlier today that he signed up for the course. So, with that being said, I'd like to thank my guests. And, Roger, if you would close the show, I'd appreciate it. Take it away.
This has been CRE Radio with Howard Klein. If you have a question or a topic you would like to discuss, Howard can be reached at 949-288-3707. That's area 949-288-3707. Or by email to howard@creradio.com. CRE Radio is a live and recorded radio show accessible from both the web and your smartphone. Visit creradio.com to download any broadcast anytime or to receive newsletters and updates from Howard. CRE Radio broadcasts are presented on an informational basis only, with the sole intent of educating our listeners. Howard and his guest conversations specifically do not intend to offer legal advice. If you need legal advice, we recommend you seek out your own counsel. Remember, laws and practices may vary from state to state. Please listen again next time to CRE Radio with Howard Klein. Unauthorized editing or copying of portions of this show without the express written consent of CRE Radio is strictly prohibited. All rights reserved.
And that's a wrap.